The world is going through changes. Changes happening at a speed that we have never seen before. This is leading to disruption, chaos, panic, fear, hysteria, and a turbulent economy and marketplace. How do you protect your wealth in a turbulent world? How do you invest for cash flow and alternative assets to escape the rat race in times of uncertainty? How do you decentralize yourself, your family, your community, your business, and your investments to become sovereign and escape the matrix? If you are looking for strategies, tactics, and techniques to escape the rat race and matrix, you are in the right place. My name is MC Lobsher, and this is Cashflow Ninja. This is Cashflow Ninja. I'm MC Lobsher. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Cashflow Ninja and spending your most valuable resource, your time, once again with me. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at cashflowninja.com. There's three different podcasts: Cashflow Ninja, Cashflow Investing Secrets, and Reset Investing Secrets at cashflowninja.com. You can also grab a copy of my book, The 21 Best Cashflow Niches, or subscribe to my newsletter, The Best Cashflow Niches Newsletter, in which I share a well-researched brand new cashflow niche every single month. And you can also join my mastermind, Cashflow Nirvana, if you're a business owner and investor looking to build and protect wealth during turbulent times. I've got a fantastic show for you. I'm joined by Nick Giambruno of the Financial Underground. Nick, great to see you.
Hey, great to be with you.
So for folks that are not familiar with you and what you do, can you just give them a little bit about your background and journey and what you're up to today?
Well, sure. I've worked for over 10 years with legendary speculator Doug Casey. Had the great opportunity to travel the world and find incredible investment opportunities, understand how the world really works, get a boots on the ground perspective in a lot of places. And I'm also a financial analyst, and I cover kind of niche investments in, the cutting edge of finance, and commodities and so forth. So I do that through the, financialunderground.com, which is my publishing platform for my financial research, and give a kind of, the idea is to get the big picture right. Because if most people in finance don't get the big picture right, they're focused on insignificant details and miss the big picture. So I try to get the big picture right, and everything flows from that.
Yeah, it definitely. I mean, the way that you view the world and the lens that you're looking through it definitely determines, where you end up, whether you're successful or not. And during these times too, it's just fascinating to see folk still focusing so on the micro level and on things that are maybe they played some role in the outcomes, but now the macro picture is so big, and there's so many moves happening and trends on a macro level that without that or having that blind spot, that could wipe out a ton of investors, right?
Oh, certainly. There's many examples in history where people miss the big picture and get wiped out, not just financially. I mean, could be worse. You could have been stuck in Europe during World War II, or stuck in Yugoslavia as it went through its civil war. So it's very important to get the big picture right, not just from a financial perspective, but from all all perspectives, really. And the way I see it is that the world is going through some changes that most people alive haven't seen before. Basically, the way the big countries organize themselves is kind of falling apart and going to reorganize on a different matter. And that's a very big thing that we haven't really seen since World War II.
Yeah, so let's dive into that a little bit geopolitically. What are you seeing from a macro perspective with regards to, just geopolitically, economic, and what's happening in the markets?
Sure. I think that, you got to look at it from the highest level and then kind of zoom in from there. And I think what I am looking at now, is how to look at the highest level. How do you organize geopolitics? And what it is there are these things called world orders. And I know that has that's a loaded term, because you've heard, you know, George H.W. Bush talk about a new world order and these kinds of things. And that's terrible. But what is he talking about? Like, what is a world order? And it is an actual thing. And really what it is how the big countries get together and set the rules of the game and, you know, divvy up the world amongst themselves. I mean, an easy way to think of it is like when you think of like a city, and in any city, there are like crime syndicates and mafias, and they divvy up different neighborhoods among themselves. And they kind of come to a balance of power between the crime families. And that's what a world order is, except on a global scale. It's like these global crime families have made an arrangement. This is your territory. This is our territory. But you know what happens? These arrangements inevitably break down, whether it's an arrangement between crime syndicates in a given city, or world orders where it's, these criminals that are between them always break down. And that's what we're looking at right now, is the current world order is breaking down. Now, the current world order has been in place since the end of World War II, because that was the last time the big powers really got into a fight and there was a power struggle among them until a new system was put in place. So that's the highest level, is looking at like what is a world order and what is going on with that. So the current era is the post-World War II era, and that's like the US-led world order. Prior to that, you know, you kind of had the Treaty of Versailles, and then prior to that, you had the Congress of Vienna, which was determined after Napoleon was defeated in the Napoleonic Wars. And that kind of set the stage for how Europe was governed for the next 100 years. Then there was World War I that broke down then. And then World War II, of course, broke down that world order. So we're in this phase where the current arrangement between the big powers is starting to break down. And that is going to lead to some major instability. So that's kind of the big, very, very big picture lens from which I'm looking at this. And so that has major implications. It's probably something that people haven't seen since World War II. And we're going, hopefully it doesn't come to open conflict between like the US, Russia, and China. That would be World War III. That's what kind of determines what a quote unquote world war is, between the big powers. And those are the big three. So hopefully it doesn't come to that, because that means, you know, nuclear war most likely. And that means billions of people dying. That's terrible. But I don't think it's going to that level yet. Hopefully not, because the way Russia and China, what they're doing is they're not trying to totally upend the world order, the arrangement that they have with the US and the Western powers. They're just trying to give themselves a bigger seat at the table within the current system. Now, whether they can manage that without triggering a war between the big powers is the $64,000 question. But that's what is going on. And at the same time, you have the Western powers, the US and so forth. And I don't like to call them Western powers, frankly, because the people who are in charge of these countries have values that are antithetical to Western civilization. So I don't like to call it the West, because the West isn't even the West anymore, because it doesn't have those values. I like to call it NATO and friends. So NATO and friends are headed downhill in every kind of metric, military, economics, culturally. So what we're looking at is a shakeup between the arrangements between the global crime syndicates that run these nation states. And that's a volatile period. And that's what we're looking at right now.
Yeah. So you've got the two blocks kind of developing, right? The NATO and friends, and then the BRICS nations, which it looks like they surpassed the G7 and GDP just recently, right? So it's almost like there's a lot of movements from NATO and friends, formerly the Western world, Western civilization, to the East. And it looks like it's capital flow, growth, and with that opportunity too, right?
Yeah, it would seem so. So, I mean, the way it's going is that the whole world order is basically a U.S. unipolar world order, and it's moving towards a more multipolar world order where you have the BRICS plus countries. I mean, it's not a perfect label, but it's a pretty good label that's representative of the countries that are more favorable to a multipolar world order. So that's kind of the two geopolitical blocks. You have NATO and friends and BRICS plus. Basically. And yeah, it is moving towards a more multipolar world order. And those countries are going to benefit. And, you know, we will see what happens. I think, I think the current world order is going to fall apart just because it doesn't have a sound foundation. And what comes next is anybody's guess. I mean, it could be a multipolar world order. It could be something else, but it looks like it's going to be a multipolar world order. And we'll have to, you know, people have to be prepared for that. And in investment wise, and also from a perspective of how they structure their business and their personal lives too, it's very important.
So on the BRICS side, the BRICS Nations Plus, because it seems like there's a ton of economic alliances that were formed. And now I think there was like 30 countries that are looking to apply, either in the process of applying or they've openly stated that they would want to apply and be a part of it. So you look like you've got that economic kind of relations and contracts being formed. And then that follows with the military, as done with Saudi Arabia and Russia. So it looks like it looks like the world is basically saying we have kind of had enough of the current the status quo, how the world order has been laid out, with NATO and France just running amok, just as one gang would run amok in a city and kind of step on the other gang's toes. I think it's finally come to a time where enough of them band together and say, we've kind of had enough of your nonsense. They now can take a stand, where in the past, if it was one-offs, you know, one-off country takes a swing at the bully, like a Libya or a Syria or Iraq and so forth, well, you're going to get clobbered by the bully. But it looks like a lot of countries now at the same time are kind of rallying around this BRICS nations kind of plus kind of block, right?
Yeah, it seems so. And a key one to watch is Saudi Arabia, because they are previously a very staunch U.S. ally. The dollar is very dependent on the whole petrodollar system, which was put into place after Nixon pulled the last link of the dollar to gold in the 70s. And that the U.S. has had a very strong, I mean, it's predated that, but that's when it really came into force. That strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. But the flip side is the Saudis get, what do the Saudis get out of it? They get protection from the United States. But then they look at, like, wait a minute, if the U.S. military ultimately backs the dollar, but the U.S. military was decisively defeated by the Taliban, how strong is this? How good is this protection worth? What is this protection worth? And the Saudis are thinking, not much. And they're trying to make arrangements with the other side. They've done a ton of things lately. Let's just list them off. They've restored relations with Iran. They've restored relations with Syria. They welcomed Syria back into the Arab League after 12 years of trying to overthrow Bashar Assad. They started doing oil and energy deals outside of the dollar. They wanted to join BRICS. They wanted to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a military cooperation organization between the Eurasian countries, the BRICS plus countries. So they've done all of that in just like a matter of weeks. And they've announced an end to the war in Yemen, which, that's a fascinating war. Most people don't even know about Yemen, but the Saudis lost in Yemen. And that's an incredible story in and of itself, that you have the richest country in the Middle East that basically, you know, has golden toilet seats. They can afford to, you know, blow all kinds of money, versus the Yemenis, who make pennies a day in flip-flops and AK-47s. And they defeated the richest country. So so the Saudis have announced an end to that. All of these moves, the Americans don't approve of at all. So this is Saudi Arabia kind of, you know, is, you want to watch them, because they kind of will show you which way the geopolitical winds are blowing. But it doesn't look good for the NATO and friends bloc. And you know what? They've completely, frankly, the NATO and friends have completely abused their role as the upholders of this world order. They didn't try to, you know, they've been causing all sorts of wars and stirring up trouble. I mean, you know, frankly, they deserve to be knocked down a peg in my view. And I hope they do, because we don't want a world government. That's a horrible thing. We want the decentralization of power to the maximum extent. Obviously, you know, a world. I don't like any of these guys. I think they're all bad guys. But I don't think one of them should have a monopoly on the whole world. That would be a horrible, horrible thing. So, yes, let's break up the power. Ideally, we would break up. There would be, you know, 8 billion world or people who do the world order. That would be the ideal. So that's not realistic. So let's break it up into as small of units as possible, in my view.
I want to take a moment to share something very important right now. Are you trying to figure out how to protect your savings from the banking collapse, which has already started, and the coming financial crisis? Most banks will fail. Deposits that are not insured by the FDIC will be lost, and there will be bank bail-ins. And this collapse in the banking system will lead to chaos in the financial system. Banks also provide loans to real estate investors. So what do you think is going to happen to lending in the event of a banking and a financial crisis? You can be proactive and position your savings to protect it and also have access to it to use it to buy discounted assets by positioning it in your own banking system through the infinite banking concept strategy. Producers Wealth has put together a presentation at yourownbankingsystem.com where you will learn how to position capital outside of the banking system and the Wall Street casino, just like the ultra wealthy, to protect it and create a pool of tax-free liquid capital to capitalize on the massive opportunity to buy discounted assets, which is coming. You can access the presentation at yourownbankingsystem.com. That's yourownbankingsystem.com. When it comes to the monopoly too, as you mentioned, the US dollar has been a monopoly. And that's another thing that you cover too and write about at Financial Underground is the monetary system. And as power is kind of shifting from one side to another side, this now sets the stage to bring about another Bretton Woods kind of moment, right?
Yeah, with the restructuring of global power, there's going to be a restructuring of money in global finance. I have no doubt about that. People are sick to death of being at the whims of the U.S. government in terms of if you don't do this, you get sanctioned. You don't do this, you get cut off from the U.S. dollar system. I mean, look, I don't want to give these guys any ideas, but their power depends on the network of the dollar usage. You would want to expand that network. Like if you were really in charge and you wanted to have more power in this world, you would want more countries using the dollar because it expands your monetary network. That would be a good thing in their view. And they're doing the self destructive behavior that limits that monetary network. So yes, there is going to be a change. But I'm not very excited about whatever monetary concoction the BRICS plus countries come up, because it's just going to be the same kind of scam, basically, but with the BRICS label on it. It's going to be a promise from a politician. That's not good money. You don't want that as money. You don't want a promise from Washington to be replaced by a promise from Beijing and Moscow. That's terrible. Why would you want that as money? Use something else as money. Use something, let the free market determine what money is. And money is not complicated. It's just something, a technology that's used to store and exchange value. That's all it is. You don't need a PhD. Actually, a PhD in economics would make you less likely to understand money because they fills your head with Keynesian garbage. All money is just that. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, you look throughout history, people have used cattle as money, salt as money, gold as money, silver as money, and so forth. It just needs, that's what money is. And that's one of the biggest distortions, I think, in the world, is that the average person, in most places, not just the US and Europe, most places, they don't even know what money is. They think it's what the government gives us, these little pieces of paper or these digits on my bank account. They don't even think, like, what is the function of money? What is it functionally doing for you? And I think that is the cheat code, frankly. Once you understand that and you can, think for yourself of what a good money is instead of just blindly taking what these crooks are giving you, then I think you're going to be light years ahead of your fellow man.
Yeah, it's impossible to have a sound and honest system when you have at the root of all this dishonest and unsound money, right? Which is the glue that keeps everything together, the medium of exchange around the world.
No, it's not possible. Let me put it as succinctly as possible. Fake money comes from the government. Real money comes from the market. If it doesn't come from the market, it's fake money. That's simple as that. So if your money is coming from a politician, it's fake money. Simple as that.
So if you look at the eight predictions for the world in 2030 that came from the World Economic Forum, that nice marketing piece they did in 2016, one of the predictions was that the U.S. will no longer be the sole superpower, and that there would be a group of countries, a number of them, that will share the power. So it looks like this is kind of playing out, and based on that, maybe you might not just have a promise from one group, one country or politician, but several, which makes it even that much worse, right? But it looks like this is the way that it's going, is that the monetary system is changing. And you've written about central bank digital currencies, where kind of this is on the agenda for it to be rolled out. What are some of the updates that you've been seeing there? Because there was a rollout in Nigeria, which at one stage, you know, they tried the carrot approach, then the stick, and now there's kind of a little bit of pushback. What are some of the things that you're seeing around CBDCs?
Well, I would say CBDCs sound very scary in theory, and they are very scary in theory. However, in practice, they're completely unworkable. And we can just look at a couple of examples. The first CBDC was the Venezuelan Petro. Did that save the Venezuelan Bolivar, or did that? No, it did nothing. Did that prevent average Venezuelan citizens from using other forms of money? No, it didn't. Look at Nigeria, the e-Naira. Did that save the Naira? No. Did that stop the Nigerians from using other forms of money? No. So look, CBDCs sound scary, and they are scary. Like, if they really could pull it off, it would be scary. But it's a completely unworkable form of money, and it makes fiat money even worse. It makes it easier for politicians to debase the currency, to control people. It doesn't take much imagination when you force this upon people that they look for other alternatives. And I think, look at what happened in Nigeria when they try to force the CBDC. Bitcoin adoption goes up. So I think we're going to see that. I think indirectly, I think they're a great Trojan horse for Bitcoin. And I think Bitcoin is a very helpful tool for the average person, because when we talk about real money comes from the market, well, there you go. That's a money that came from the market. That's not enforced on anybody. So I think that is a very important tool for people, is to have money, free market, hard money. And when I say hard money, I mean hard to produce. That's what it means. Hard to produce. Money that's not easy money is easy to produce. You don't want easy money. Would you want to save your life savings in arcade tokens and frequent flyer miles or government confetti? That you don't want to do that. So to me, the top two forms of free market money are gold, physical gold in your possession, and Bitcoin, where you control the keys and nobody else. That would be my recommendation for good forms of money.
And that's kind of how to basically unplug from a failing system, which is tied obviously to the economy and markets, but just to start from a solution kind of outside, how do we build solutions to this turbulent world that you're describing, the power shifts going on, which is going to result in, you know, more conflict or an expansion of conflict, changes in the monetary system, changes in just the currency system within countries with central banks. Gold and Bitcoin is two of the solutions that you've proposed, and that people use to decentralize themselves.
Yeah, well, gold and Bitcoin, they have the most important attribute of money, and that is hardness. Like I was saying, it's hard to produce, that nobody can just arbitrarily create more of it. That's the most important thing. And I like to use the example of gold versus platinum, because hardness is not quite the same thing as scarcity. They are related concepts, but they're not the same. For example, platinum is scarcer than gold. There are fewer ounces of platinum in the world, far fewer than there are ounces of gold. So wouldn't platinum be a better form of money than gold? The answer is no, it wouldn't be. And the reason is because platinum is not a hard asset and gold is. Now, that doesn't seem very intuitive, but let me explain. The gold annual, you can measure hardness. So hard to produce. How do you measure that? It's a measure of something called stock to flow. So when you look at annual production to existing supply, the new supply of gold each year is about 1-2% of annual supply. Of the existing supply that's above ground. That's insignificant. That means nobody can arbitrarily inflate the gold supply. If you look at the platinum annual production versus the platinum annual supply, it is equal or exceeds it, which means that if you have every year, the platinum market gets swung either which way by industrial conditions. So if there's more platinum demand, it's going to really offset, change, you know, the dynamics here. And gold doesn't have that because gold only grows 1-2% per year. Platinum basically grows equivalent to its supply each year. And that's not a good monetary attribute where you can have those kind of forces easily swing the market balance. It's not a good monetary feature. So that's what makes gold unique among other commodities, is that it has such a small, its annual production is so small relative to the existing amount. That is a very unique feature. And gold has that by far. And that's what makes it attractive as a store of value, because nobody can debase gold arbitrarily. And Bitcoin has that same attribute. And none of the other cryptocurrencies do, because they don't have credibility. Their monetary policies don't have any credibility. Bitcoin is really the only one you can say that nobody can change. The Chinese government can't change it. US government can't change it. Elon Musk can't change it. Jeff Bezos can't. Nobody can change it. That is very important for its credibility. If you look at every other cryptocurrency from Ethereum on down, there's a group of people that can get together and change things. They have no credibility. Their monetary policies have no credibility. They're like the Federal Reserve, the FOMC. They can just get together and change the rules. That Bitcoin is the only one where that is not true. That's why it's very, very important to draw a very clear line between Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies, in my view.
What's your take on silver as just as a medium of exchange too? Gold, obviously, a great store of value. You've mentioned Bitcoin too, store of value and a medium of exchange. What's your take on silver?
Well, silver is more of an industrial metal. It really is. It has a monetary component. If you look at how silver, the demand for silver, it's about roughly, I think, 75% industrial, 25% monetary. Monetary meaning somebody who's storing or exchanging value in silver, whereas using it for an industrial purpose. Gold is the opposite. Gold is like 85, 90% monetary and 10, 12% industrial. So silver has some monetary premium associated with it. However, in my view, gold is a far better money than silver, because if you look at that most important attribute of money that I said before, hardness, and it can be quantified in the something called the stock to flow ratio, the annual production of silver is far higher relative to the existing stockpiles of silver than it is for gold, which means industrial conditions can swing the value of silver way further than they can for gold. So I think gold is much more suitable as money. And if you look at what happens when silver spikes, what do people do? They go and melt their silverware. People find more supply. So the supply is not as inelastic as gold's is. So no, I think gold is a better form of money. I would still say, though, that being said, it is not a bad idea to have, say, 100 ounces of silver as a total emergency in case we have a total Mad Max situation. You don't want to pay for your groceries in gold coins. And, you know, in that case, yes, maybe having some silver coins to barter for some essential goods is not a bad idea, but I would not use it above that in terms of like saving. I think gold is way better for saving. And for speculating on money, I think Bitcoin is a good speculation too. So that's how I would kind of rate those, you know, three. And I think those are the three top forms of free market forms of money. But I think there's a clear hierarchy there too.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you sharing that. One of the things, and I want to definitely touch into the opportunities that you see too for great asymmetric investing opportunities during this turbulent time. These three that you already mentioned are great, just wealth preservation tools. Talk to a little bit about the debt, because we were in a debt-based monetary system. So I always said, well, if you want to take this system down and roll out a new system, Occam's razor is sort of, well, you implode all the debt, right? You have debt jubilees and you take the entire debt down because that's what the system is based on. What's your take on what you're currently seeing around the world with regards to the debt markets? And what's your take on some of the debt jubilee content that you've shared in your newsletter?
Well, it's the debt market is completely distorted. It's not a free market. The bond market is not a free market. It's central banks are, you know, think about it. It's not a free market of buyers, of lenders and borrowers. It's not. It's a rigged market where you have an entity that can create money out of thin air and then buys up its selected bonds. It's a totally fake market that's been completely distorted by central banks. And they've brought up until very recently, interest rates to the lowest levels in human history. Now, that not on a natural basis. That didn't happen from the market. That happened because central planners at central banks did this. And let me just say, central banks are a completely unnecessary institution. You do not need a politburo of central planners central planning the economy. You can't central plan the economy. Nobody, central planning doesn't work. It doesn't work when the Soviet Union central plans, you know, cars or shoes, and it doesn't work when the Federal Reserve and other central banks centrally plan money. It just doesn't work. And nonetheless, it's not only does it not work, it's not necessary. You don't need this thing. It's a complete parasite on productive people and the economy. So that being said, you know, it affects the bond market because that is primarily where they pump their distortions. When they create new money out of thin air, they typically buy bonds. So that has blown up an enormous debt bubble, which has kind of had some air come out of it because the inflation has forced them to go in the other direction now and raise rates. But I think that's only temporary before they start flooding the market with money again. I wouldn't want to touch bonds, frankly. First of all, it's a contract. A bond is a contract, and it's a contract for somebody to pay you at a later date in government confetti. I don't want to be paid in government confetti. Like, that's a terrible deal. So I don't want that. And then second of all, you have to deal with all these distortions. And then third, you have to deal with the creditworthiness of the person who's selling you the bond. So I wouldn't touch bond. They are horrible. I mean, the whole thing needs to frankly blow up and be reconstituted on a more sound basis, or I would ever be interested in bonds. The only exception is, and most people have never heard of this, but El Salvador is issuing Bitcoin-backed bonds. It's called volcano bonds that harness their geothermal energy and those are something you really should look into. That is a one exception in the bond market that I think is interesting. And now I wrote about that on financialunderground.com. You can check that out for more detail on those. Other than that, forget about all bonds, I would say. They're all garbage, and they're all they're going to zero because I think fiat currency is going to zero. If somebody has a promise to pay you in the future fiat currency, well, that promise is as you know, if the underlying fiat currency is garbage, well, that promise is garbage. So I think nonetheless, the world is saturated in debt. I mean, at least Americans are, and most of the other parts of the world are too. So I think there is going to be some kind of restructuring, maybe a jubilee, you know, which is a repudiation of debt. And I think the repudiation is going to happen through inflation because they're not, or at least in the US, because they're not going to just outright default. Why would they outright default when they have the option to print money? No country ever outright defaults if they can print money. You know, look at like Argentina or Lebanon. The only reason they defaulted is because they took on debt in a foreign currency that they couldn't print. If the Argentine government had debt in pesos, you can bet they would print pesos before they would default. If the Lebanese government had debt in Lebanese lira, you can bet that they would print the liras before they would default in liras. So I think the same thing is going to happen in the US, and we're going to see default by inflation. The bottom line is that people who store their wealth in dollars, in fiat currencies, in bonds, this is going to be an enormous wealth transfer because all that monetary energy is going to get sucked out and sent somewhere else, namely to government people, politicians, and people close to the money printer, and also people with hard assets whose value can't be inflated. So the mechanism by which they're going to do this wealth transfer is the money printer. And the people on the losing end are going to be the people who are holding these fiat currencies, these confetti currencies, and people who have bonds and bank accounts, and the people on the other side who are closest to the money printing, and also people who hold hard assets are going to be the big winners. I don't want this to happen. This is not a just outcome. This is an unfair outcome. But nonetheless, that's the reality is, and you might as well position yourself accordingly instead of just donating your money to these criminals.
I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors, Penumbra Solutions. Life Settlements Investments have allowed financial and banking institutions to not only buy their equity contractually, but also diversify their capital from any economic, market, and geopolitical risk. It's been part of the billion-dollar blueprint followed by institutional investors. If you're an accredited investor, you can also now participate in this vehicle with enormous growth potential. You can watch an informational webinar presented by one of the premier organizations providing live settlement investments, Penumbra Solutions, at cashflowninja.com/live settlements. That's cashflowninja.com/live settlements. The password to access that webinar is Penumbra, all lowercase. Yeah, so if the debt bubble pops, I mean, just think about the ramifications, as you mentioned. Like, yeah, we've covered the governments, which are all bankrupt. The states, provinces, which are all bankrupt. Municipalities, cities, towns, they're all bankrupt. And then look at corporations, which, I mean, they're not really producing anything. The stock prices is just using debt to buy up more of their stock. So their production's gone down significantly. They're dependent on debt. And then the consumer, which it looks like debt levels here, especially in the United States, are again back at all-time highs, where it looks like people are just, you know, the average person's just struggling, and the average person's using a credit card basically to make ends meet at the moment. So all of that pops, and then, you know, all of the other bubbles. Think of equity markets, think of housing markets, and so forth. What's some of your take of just what you're seeing unfolding in the real estate market, and more specifically, like the commercial real estate market?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all related. I mean, how you can't look at the real estate market divorced from the debt market. They're completely related. So, yes, there's been a bond bubble. What has the bond bubble helped blow up? A real estate bubble, because real estate sits on debt. It's all financed by debt, at least in the US and in, you know, a lot of other places. So, yeah, I mean, look, if the debt bubble blows up, you're going to see the real estate bubble blow up too, because a lot of that money that was pumped into the real estate market was, funny money, because there was cheap debt because of central banks manipulating the interest rate lower than they otherwise would be in free market conditions. So, look, I mean, and you know, to a lesser degree, that's true in the equity markets and in other markets. It's tough when you have so much distortions pumped into the markets. I mean, look at some of these companies that have ridiculous, and still they have ridiculous valuations, and some companies that don't have any earnings that are getting, you know, ridiculous valuations. And then you have, you know, these woke companies like, you know, Budweiser and so forth, making completely suicidal moves that cost them billions of dollars in market cap. And I mean, to what? So they can improve their ESG score. So BlackRock can, I mean, this is an example of the fiat system, where you have an entity like BlackRock, who is very close to the money printer. BlackRock is very, very close to the money printer. BlackRock facilitated a lot of the Federal Reserve programs and bailouts in the past. So they're right next to the money printer. And then companies making completely seemingly self-destructive moves, like Budweiser and all these other woke corporations, you know, alienating half of their customers to appease to 1%. That doesn't make business sense at all. But they're doing it to curry favor with companies like BlackRock, who are plugged into the money printer. So it completely distorts business. I mean, that's, you wouldn't see that in a totally free market economy, because there would be no money printer to plug into.
Yep.
Nonetheless, how on earth do you invest in an environment like this that is so corrupt and so distorted? It's not easy. I frankly don't want to step into this stuff unless I see something that's very clearly attractive and something that I believe in. Otherwise, you know, I would recommend to sit on the sidelines in hard assets and just watch this, wait until something attractive comes up. I don't want to play this casino game where it's completely rigged with central banks and insiders. That does not look good. And I think that has to collapse and it has to be rebuilt on a sounder foundation and a free market foundation. I mean, what a lot of people misunderstand is they look at like the US and they look at like a Wall Street. They think this is free market capitalism. It's not at all free market capitalism. When you have fake money, how can you have free market capitalism with fake money and fake interest rates? You simply cannot. It's a game of cronyism and insiders. So sure, if you want to play that game, you know, good luck to you.
Yeah, I actually was having a conversation with someone the other day where they asked me about a certain valuation on an asset class. I don't even remember the exact asset that they were asking. And I said, who knows what anything is worth right now? You know, because it's so distorted, to your point. I mean, you just flooded And we can't even get an accurate number of the amount of fiat currency that was flooded into the system. That varies significantly too. Maybe you have a better number that's closer, but I've tried to look into that. I mean, that's also like a rabbit hole that you're going down to. So who knows? We don't even have an accurate number for how much just fiat currency was flooded, right?
No, you don't. And so what if they give you a number? Would you believe them? How can you verify it? If the Chinese government tells you what something is, would you believe it? Why would you believe any government statistic? So the Fed could say one thing and do a completely another thing. I mean, I wouldn't put that past them at all. So it really is tricky to invest in this kind of environment with so many distortions. Really, you can try to speculate. I mean, investing and speculating are two different things. So I would stick to trying to speculate now, and just because it's basically impossible to invest with all these distortions. And I think the biggest speculation is the monetary issue, which speculating is just taking advantage of a distortion in the marketplace. And I think the biggest distortion in the marketplace is that the average person doesn't even know what good money is. And I think that is, it might not be a revelation to your viewers and your listeners, but nonetheless, I think that's a very big distortion that you can bank on. That is something I am comfortable with putting my money into, is betting on superior monetary alternatives in this environment.
And that, you know, as you mentioned, it's a time for capital preservation and protection, hard assets, but it also, in doing so, you're also putting yourself in a good asymmetric position financially, because there's such an enormous information gap of what the public perceives as money versus what actually money is.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. No, that's exactly correct. It's astounding. I mean, it's as if, like, if you went back in time into the Soviet Union, you ask the average person, you know, where do cars come from? Where do shoes come from? They would say, oh, they come from the government. You know, who else could make the cars? Who else could make the shoes? They couldn't conceive of the fact that a private company seeking profits could make shoes or cars. And it's exactly the same kind of mentality when you ask some people. You don't have to ask them where shoes or cars come from, but ask them, where does money come from? It's exactly the same response. You get that same kind of, like, you know, deer in the headlights stare, and, oh, it comes from the government. Where else could the money come? It's the same kind of thing. So you're capitalizing on that distortion, and it's a massive distortion.
Nick, some of the other things that you've covered and researched some of the resource sector and have written about that. Is that also a place that you would look at from a strategy perspective, wealth preservation first, positioning yourself for asymmetric trends, which is the sound money trend? But what are some of the things that you're looking at there, if anything, at the moment?
Yeah, well, look, I think, strategic commodities make sense. I mean, you look as the world fragments to a multipolar world order, I think there's going to be more friction in trade and a scramble between countries to secure their essential commodities. I think you can see this in rare earth metals. You can see this in lithium. You can see this in copper. You can see this in uranium. And all these kinds of things. So I think strategic commodities make a lot of sense. And also, they're a good inflation hedge when there's monetary debasement, which I think is a guarantee. On top of that, you have this geopolitical development. So I think, select commodities and strategic commodities make a lot of sense, in addition to those alternative monetary commodities that we were talking about before.
And then also another question I had for you, because I think you mentioned this at one stage too. What's going on in the different world, the carbon world? Because there was a lot of noise and a lot of just media coverage on that, but it's kind of simmered. What's going on there?
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll simplify it. It's a giant scam, is what it is. It's a giant scam. What is a carbon credit? It's a make-believe. I wouldn't call it a commodity. It's not a commodity. It's a make-believe thing that a government created out of nothing. Because they think there's this so-called climate change and they need to impose carbon credits on everybody. This is not only a scam, and this is not only a bad investment. I think this is a mechanism to enslave people, and it needs to be rejected, not just from an investment point of view. It should be rejected from an investment point of view, but I think it needs to be rejected from a personal freedom point of view, because what they want to do is institute, it's like a social credit system with Western characteristics. They want to institute a social credit system based on your carbon consumption. Basically, carbon, whenever they talk about carbon, just substitute it for plant food. Carbon is plant food. And carbon is an essential element in life. When they talk about regulating carbon, carbon touches every aspect of life. That means they want to control and regulate every single aspect of your life. So this needs to be completely rejected. And on the other side, it's a fake investment that governments pulled out of their butts and told people, well, now you need to start, you know, rationing carbon, and we'll give you permission to emit carbon with carbon credits, and now you can trade these things. So I think it needs to be rejected, not just from a lousy investment, because it's not going to last. I mean, think about it. You think this carbon thing, the second that people, you're going to see this in Europe too, that people are getting poorer and they're losing their jobs, their electricity bills are going up, the food is becoming more expensive. Do you think they're really going to want to pay more for everything in life for this stupid carbon credit thing? I think as soon as times get hard, people are going to just, they're going to be furious at this, and they're rightfully furious at this. So no, I think it needs to be rejected.
I think people are starting to realize too what a kind of scam this was. And then a forced one was pulled on them, because everybody was kind of like, well, you know, it's for the environment and that kind of thing. And before you know it, now it's credit card companies are sending statements with scores on. And now, people are setting up ETFs and funds and streaming companies and all this stuff in that space. And I'm like, it's you talk about fictitious things in our lifetime. I mean, it was just quite incredible to see.
Well, yeah. And it's not just, like I said, I hope it crashes and burns, frankly, because it's not just a bad investment or like a scam like Bernie Madoff. It's not just that. It's a mechanism. It's like instituting a social credit system on the West and all the nasty things that go with a social credit system. So do you want to invest in that? And this is all promoted by the World Economic Forum and all these criminals. These are all criminals, frankly. So you want to put money into that and hope that succeeds? Okay, maybe you could make a nickel off of that. I mean, the people who do this, it's like they would sell their mother for a nickel. So there are some things that I just find philosophically repulsive, and this is one of them. And I don't think it's a good investment. Even if I found it philosophically repulsive, and I do, I don't think it's a good investment because I think it's not going to be. I think it will fall apart as soon as economic times are hard. Nobody is going to be clamoring for carbon credits. It's as simple as that, in my view.
So one habit I've observed from wealthy and successful folks is that they're always learning and studying and researching, and you're always researching and reading and so forth. What are things that are interesting to you currently that you're looking into and learning more about and researching?
Well, I think people really should be watching what's going on in El Salvador. It's kind of off the radar, but El Salvador is a very important country. It was because of what it's doing. Like I said, with these volcano bonds, that's going to totally upend not only the bond market, it's going to upend the IMF model, because it will show that these little third world countries can raise billions of dollars without the IMF and without China too, because China's kind of like the alternative to the IMF. It's a completely new paradigm. So I think people need to be paying attention to that. They also were the first country to make Bitcoin legal money in their country. That's huge. That's groundbreaking. And then you look at what Najib Bukele has done. He's really cleaned up that place and made it one of the safest countries, from one of the most dangerous countries in the Western Hemisphere, measured by homicides, to one of the safest. I mean, it's an incredible transformation. So I think people really, really should be looking at that. And it's kind of flying under the radar screen of most mainstream people. But I think there's something big going on in El Salvador.
It's very interesting. I've been following that too since they started to announce Bitcoin as legal tender there. And tourism is just skyrocketing. People are going there. And of course, Bukele knew he had to clean up the streets and clean up the country to make it safe again. And to your point, just the drop in the crime has been astounding to see. And he's done this in a relatively short time too, right?
Oh yeah, he's done it in a short time. So yeah, I mean, watch El Salvador. A lot of things are happening there, and the mainstream is not looking. So that is a very important place to keep your eyes on.
So the debt model, you know, just for folks listening to this, with the IMF debt model, is they send in the John Perkinses, the economic hitman. They enslave the country through the IMF and the World Bank, that pays for projects that Western corporations get all the deals for. Obviously, a little bit off to the side to, you know, a local contractor, which is usually a president that has a brother that now all of a sudden becomes a massively important person in, you know, the contract world or the contract space. The country gets destroyed, the developing country. I mean, the poverty is crazy. No one served there, and it just enriched a couple of folks that are right at the top, and then obviously Western corporations and so forth. And then you were sharing that they issued these bonds, and this is now basically just taking care of the outstanding IMF debt that they had, right?
Well, that is the idea. And let me just say real quick, the IMF is not an entity of the free market. The IMF does not need to please customers. The IMF does not need to produce profits. It is an entity of central planning, and it's a horrible entity. I hope it collapses. I hope it goes away, because it brings nothing but misery to the world, frankly. So it is not a good thing. So what they've been doing is exactly what you've said, and it's a way for the U.S. to basically gain geopolitical influence by debt slavery of other countries. Horrible thing, terrible thing. But other countries, these little third world countries, where else are they going to get money? And they can't, you know, borrow money otherwise. I mean, I guess they can, but they need more money. So this is a new model that they're doing, is this Bitcoin backed loan. Basically, they're borrowing money through not through New York. The debt is going to be issued on something called you'll have to see, it's going to be issued through Bitfinex, and I think it's on the Liquid network, which means it is a token, but it is a official security, which means it's been registered as a security, whereas all these other things are not securities. They're kind of like trading in a Wild West fashion, and the government is just going to go after them. This is an official security. A bond offering is a security, and they're registering it as a security. But the point is that it's open to almost anybody can invest in this stuff. Now, the details haven't been totally worked out, but they're not going through Wall Street investment banks to make this issuance. They're going through, I think, Liquid and Bitcoin and issuing it. What are they doing with this? They're buying Bitcoin, and they're buying Bitcoin mining infrastructure to place in El Salvador that will produce them more cash flow, more Bitcoin, because they'll be able to harness their abundant geothermal energy, which otherwise wouldn't make economic sense, because you have this abundant geothermal energy and nothing to connect it to, no grid to connect it to. But with Bitcoin mining, you can connect that otherwise stranded energy and convert it into a hard asset. You can convert it into Bitcoin. Now, that is not just unique to El Salvador. That's something that has never existed before in commodity production. Usually, energy production needs to be where it's consumed. Not anymore. So if you have like a volcano in the middle of El Salvador, you can monetize that. And that's what they're doing. And what are they going to do with the funds that they raise? Well, they've indicated they want to pay off the IMF and pay off any external debt. And Bukele has already started doing that. He started to pay off some of the bondholder, the El Salvador bondholders. He's made massive repayments. So the idea is to refinance El Salvador on these volcano bonds and tell the IMF and these Wall Street investment banks to go take a hike. And I think that's going to be huge. And I think he has a very good, look, nothing is certain, but I think he has a very good chance of pulling it off. And if he does, it's going to be huge.
I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors. My friend Dave Zook says, you can be conventional or you can be wealthy. Pick one. At The Real Asset Investor, Dave and his team bring their investors high-yield investment opportunities across several asset classes for cash flow, tax impact, and equity growth. He and his team are one of the top 5 ATM operators in the country, and they have an investment opportunity available to accredited investors right now in the ATM space. To learn more about their ATM funds that produce tax-free cash flow, visit therealassetinvestor.com. That's therealassetinvestor.com. And that's a great strategy to get out from that grip, especially right now with interest rates going up. All of those IMF loans are dollar loans. So countries, mm-hmm. developing countries, I mean, I see it in South Africa too, which is a huge squeeze on them. All that IMF money, interest rates go up, and now all of a sudden you need more dollars. So it kind of keeps the whole dollar hegemony kind of going too, the system that they've set up for a while, especially in developing countries. So that's pretty exciting to see that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you got to think of it from their perspective. They want people to use dollars, and they want people to run on a hamster wheel and chase after dollars. That's good for them. So from their perspective, they want more people chasing after dollars. This is why I think it's so stupid, so short-sighted with all these sanctions, because these sanctions are actually limiting the dollar's network. If you wanted to increase your geopolitical power, you would want to increase your currency's network, not decrease it. So in theory, that's what they would want to do. They would want to increase the dollar's network, which gives them more leeway to, you know, basically they can print more money if there's more people chasing dollars, and that's what they would want. But so they're still pulling this game, you know, they're sanctioning some countries, but they're still promoting the dollar in other places. But I think these days, these kind of gimmicks and these games are going to come to an end rather quickly.
So, Nick, we talk a lot about the show business investing and just how to build portfolios and asymmetric opportunities and so forth. But it's also about legacy and leaving a legacy. So I always ask my first time guest, if you cannot pass on any money to future generations and you are only allowed to pass on three principles or values to them to build success and achieve success and also live an incredible life full of happiness, what would they be?
Yeah, well, three things. I think, you know, the most important thing I would want to teach my heirs is how to think for themselves. It's really pathetic how most people allow other people to do their thinking for them. So I would be fine as a parent if my kids came to different conclusions than me. And in fact, I expect it. That's totally natural. That's what happens with parents and kids. However, I want them to come to their own conclusions and not have somebody else do the thinking for them. So I think that's very important. Learn how to think for yourself. Now, that's not an easy thing to do. That takes a long time and it takes practice. Number two, I would suggest go travel. And that was at least for me, one of the most important things was to go out and see radically different countries in terms of culture, in terms of economic stature around the world. So I think, you know, go out and travel, think for yourself. And also, you got to do things. If you want to live an extraordinary life and have extraordinary results, you have to do things that most people don't do. So you have to learn to have a very good work ethic. You got to be the fastest person in the race. I mean, you got to put the work into doing that, and you can't be, you know, lazy and, you know, sleeping in. You got to really get up and hustle. So I would try to really impress those three values. Think for yourself, get a global perspective, and hustle.
Awesome. Appreciate you sharing that. Nick, where can folks follow you? Where could they learn more about the work that you do at International Man and Financial Underground? And where can they stay informed of all the future projects that you're involved with?
Sure. The easiest way is go to financialunderground.com. We have a wonderful special report that tells you all about some very important strategies to deal with some of the things we've been talking about today. So go there, financialunderground.com. And there's that special report, but also on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Giambruno, and I put a lot of content out there too. And also Nostr. If you're, I don't know, your audience might not be familiar with Nostr. Nostr is a decentralized protocol, kind of like Twitter, but it actually works. We've heard a lot of these things. So I'm on Nostr too. You can check me out there too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your journey and your knowledge and providing so much value for my listeners and my viewers.
Absolutely. It was great. We'll have to do it again.
And thank you to you, the listener and the viewer, for spending the most valuable resource, your time, once again with me on the Cashflow Ninja. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at CashflowNinja.com. That's CashflowNinja.com. There's three podcasts, Cashflow Ninja, Cashflow Investing Secrets, and Recent Investing Secrets at CashflowNinja.com. You can grab a copy of my book, The 21 Best Cashflow Niches. You can subscribe to my newsletter, The Best Cashflow Niches Newsletter, in which I share a brand new, well-researched cashflow niche every single month. And you can also join my mastermind, my Inner Circle Cashflow Nirvana, if you're a business owner and an investor looking to protect and build wealth during turbulent times. Until next time, live infinitely. This presentation is for educational and informational purposes only. The information being presented and considered does not consider your particular financial objectives or situation, and it does not make personalized recommendations. This material is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified tax and legal advisor or other qualified professionals, and you should not use the information in place of a customized consultation with a licensed professional regarding your specific personal financial objectives, situation, and needs. We believe the information provided is reliable, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, timeliness, or completeness.